Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name is Andrew Popel, and today I'm joined on the show by Ernest Price. The Final Draft Podcast explores books, writing, and literary culture. Every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. And here at Final Draft, we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing. From debut authors to the authors that you know and love, these conversations we look at the issues that drive the storytelling, a way to discover more from the books you love. Because these are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people. I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands. Acknowledging these are unceded lands and treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Ernest Price is joining me on the show today. His novel is called The Pyramid of Needs. If you tuned in for the radio show, you will know that this has been an absolute favourite of mine. This book explores family, it explores the transgender experience. In the novel, Ernest looks at a man who has to return home to a family that has rejected him. And he does this with so much heart. He does it with pathos, he does it with humour. It's a truly lovely book that I cannot wait to share. So join me as we discover Ernest Price's The Pyramid of Needs. My name is Andrew Popel, and I am welcoming to the show Ernest Price. Ernest is a transgender man working as a secondary English teacher in Narm, Melbourne. His writing has been published by Queer Stories and Overland, and we're going to be talking about The Pyramid of Needs, which is his first novel. Ernest, welcome. I'm so excited about this chat.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to introduce The Pyramid of Needs because Linda is about to hit the big time. The fact that there aren't a lot of 70-year-olds going viral just means it will be even more sensational when she does, and viral clicks can't help but lead to more sales of her Supreme Self supplements. Jack is living his best life as a teacher in Narm, Melbourne, or at least he's trying to when his older sister Alice gives him a call. Their mother has taken a fall while live streaming at their home in Noosa. Jack hasn't spoken to Linda since he came out as a trans man more than 10 years ago. Alice can talk to him about regret, but why does he have to put himself at risk for the family who rejected him? I want to start by saying how much I loved The Pyramid of Needs, and I begin this way partly just in case my first question implies anything to the contrary. Okay, so Ernest, in my notes I've written, the opening pages are depressing and I really don't like Linda. Now, of course, little did I know that Linda was going to get a whole lot worse, practically morphing into this kind of fun show mirror of an internet cooker. How did you feel about it, Linda, though, as she was emerging on the page for you?
It's a really interesting proposition because I fought a lot with, I guess, my compulsion to descend into caricature, which I think Linda is at some point in time. She really does show some of the worst elements of that part of internet culture, whether it's the pyramid scheme that she's immersed in, the sort of wacky underbelly of wellness culture, and the way that that intersects with some of the worst aspects of social media. And it all kind of culminates in this mess that is Linda, who has, I think, possibly the least self-awareness of any character I've ever come across, whilst simultaneously thinking she is incredibly self-aware. So it's really quite a proposition for anyone who has to come into contact with her.
Can I poke at that notion of caricature there? Because there is definitely a sense of Linda tilting dangerously towards caricature, but I don't know if this is something that's always... I feel like 10, 20 years ago, Linda would have been more of a caricature, and now she exists in this liminal zone of, I don't know, I think she might exist.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are things in Linda that are, I hope, things we can empathize with. The point that she is at and the way that all of those longings that she has manifest, it's terrifying. But the desire there to make a better life for herself and her family, to at least notionally improve a lot of women in the world, these are not disgusting ideas inherently, but the pathway that she is taking, I guess, to try and realize some of those ambitions really does, I guess, destroy a lot of the people who are close to her and supposed to be the people who love her and care for her.
That sounds like a really hard thing to wrestle with too. Like, you and I know what Linda is, where she's going with this, and we know what she's done. What you're sort of saying there is acknowledging that some of this might come from an some of this might be coming from an okay place? Like, is that something we have to wrestle with larger, that people doing really horrible things actually feel at heart that they're doing the right thing?
And I think, I mean, this is one of the perpetual questions we probably all ask ourselves in our interpersonal relationships, to what extent there's almost an internal logic to some of the monsters that we might interact with. And I think Linda, at times, her actions are monstrous. But certainly I think, you know, she was a young woman in an era where women were at best sort of to the sidelines of the business world that she wanted to enter. And she certainly had to wrestle with, you know, the limitations that she faced as a woman in the workforce. Of course, what she internalized as a result of that is not necessarily a set of lessons that I would have liked her to learn. Mm. But nonetheless, as you say, perhaps there is something here that is not inherently evil or inherently bad. It is her way of making space for herself as a woman in the world, and in a world that was, I guess, closed to her at many points during her life.
Mm. And so we leave Linda prone, frantically figuring out how she can turn this tumble into more clicks, and we next meet Jack in his classroom, preparing or perhaps bracing himself for the next lesson. Jack is this glorious melange of noble intentions and angst about his place in the world. Structurally, though, was it important for you to alternate these chapters, almost to have Jack counterbalance Linda in the reader's mind?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things I was really interested with in writing the book was about the way that our family does not predetermine our path in life. And I think to have, I guess, this juxtaposition between a character who, as much as Jack at times is driven a little by his ego and, you know, perhaps does not fully think through all of his actions and their impacts on others, he is much more conscious of his place in the world, as you said. And I think trying to balance out that sense in the reader's mind to I guess offer a glimmer of hope that perhaps no matter where we come from in a biological sense, that there is the possibility of a different pathway that we can tread in the world.
Yeah, I feel like there's almost a shame in the, I guess, in the organics of your writing. Those two juxtaposing chapters don't, as far as I can recall, don't do anything to directly state the relationship. And of course, the reader goes in knowing this relationship. That's covers and blurbs spoil that. But the organics of it really give us the chance to find, I guess, find that commonality, but also empathize more with Jack as we see. It's just like, oh, you got to deal with that.
Yeah. And I think it's probably actually literally about the halfway point in the book where they physically meet for the first time. And so there, as you say, there's this chance for the reader to develop an independent relationship with each of them. And I think to anticipate what a potential meeting might look like for both of the characters and the way in which, I guess, that physical proximity undoes some of the work both Linda and Jack have done to keep their lives separate from each other.
So we are, we're jumping in the general sense ahead here. Time with family forces Jack, though, into a host of traumatic situations around his gender identity. But when we first meet him, he reflects, this is in that second chapter, he reflects, these days being transgender was a shortcut to cultural relevance with students who otherwise found him daggy. Can you talk a little bit about these like clashing, almost contradictory impulses between, I guess, cultural relevance and just wanting to like live an everyday life?
And I think this is something that Jack as a character really wrestles with internally throughout the book, that there is a, I guess, almost an internalized, not quite transphobia, but sort of a repulsion about everything that goes along with his identity and wanting not necessarily to hang his hat on his gender identity. But at the same time, he really, you know, wants this kind of almost cool uncle feeling in his professional life where he can relate to the teenagers that he's working with. He's getting to an age where he doesn't have necessarily that natural connection on a cultural level with the teenagers. So this is almost something that he sees as, yes, as we said, a kind of point of relevance when he's otherwise aging out of relevance for those teenagers who are predictably scathing, as teenagers are wont to be.
Mm. Like right about now, I want to take us on an entire side quest about how, you know, like you can watch Euphoria, but you're probably never going to TikTok dance. And, and then just like, because you are a teacher as well, and there is a broad, I guess, cultural conversation around, I don't even want to give this person's name air, but I think you know what I'm talking about here. They're like a certain gender champion who I understand young men are really latching onto. Is that sort of, like, without it being directly stated in the book, is that part of what we're talking about? Like having any sort of in to begin the work of teaching?
Absolutely. And I think the online discourse around issues of gender and the ways in which young, as you mentioned, young men in particular are having to engage with some of these questions in the darkest possible way. I think that that whole idea and that whole question for adolescence was something I was really interested to explore in the text. And I think having myself grown up in queer communities as an adult, you know, there is a way in which queer communities, you know, the old idea of a delayed adolescence and the way that people have sort of come to themselves as a more authentic, real version of themselves later, can at times give people in the queer community a greater in with adolescence to sort of understand and bridge some of the gaps that exist. But I certainly think for Jack, he is, as you mentioned right at the start, in this really paradoxical position of, on the one hand, wanting to just be Mr. Taylor in the classroom and to not really bring that to his workplace. And on the other hand, he actually, I guess, has this more idealistic side where he wants to be the role model that he never had in the classroom, to be able to challenge the kind of ideas that you were just referring to, and to bring something different to the lives of the young people that he's working with.
Yeah, I promise, Ernest, we are definitely getting back to the book, and I'm not turning this into a sociology.
I think it's all there in the book. It's all there somewhere.
Yeah, but I'm taking this even slightly further afield, because I was really interested when you there talked about this idea of within the queer community a delayed adolescence, the things that you are not allowed to live because of outside pressures. Do you have any sense of how that kind of butts up against this other phenomenon that we exist with of kid adulthood, you know, where, you know, adolescents who literally can get to their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, and are still living in that space that they never really wanted to grow out of?
And yeah, it's really interesting because I think Jack is a really interesting example of that, because on the one hand, he was out of the family home very young. He was financially independent, which has gotten him in some financial strife as he goes throughout the book. And if you compare him to his sister, Alice, who we meet very soon in our timeline that we're discussing here, you know, he's straddling this weird cross between being an independent adult far before Alice was, being financially independent, but at the same time, he hasn't met those, I guess, check marks that a more heteronormative cisgender member of the family, his sister, has met in terms of she's married, she's got kids, etc. So it's again a weird paradox where he's had that independence really early, but he hasn't followed the narrative of the life that his sister has had.
All right, we promise we're getting back on track. So Linda's taken a fall while live streaming to her followers. This necessitates Jack and Alice rushing to Noosa to check on their parents. So much of the drama and, I guess, the historical tension within the family, it stems from Linda and, to a lesser extent, my goodness, Peter. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You so beautifully kind of fade Peter that I momentarily forgot his name. It extends from their adherence to Supreme Self, a kind of wellness pyramid scheme. Tell me about pyramid schemes and how they ended up at the heart of the novel.
I've always been fascinated by the world of the pyramid scheme, particularly the intersection with wellness culture and the kind of financial self-help, your rich dad, poor dad books, that whole industry that built up in the 90s, in particular in Australia. Full disclosure, my family was involved in this world of sort of pyramid schemes. I think there are a whole range of things that interest me about it. I think a lot of those kind of pyramid schemes, like Supreme Self, the fictional iteration of it, preyed on women in particular, and women who didn't have a lot of other financial opportunities for supporting their families. It's this whole idea of, you know, stems back to Tupperware kind of schemes. And there's a fantastic podcast series, The Dream, which looks at the way that this culture developed in the US in particular. And it's got this such a murky intersection with women's liberation and the fight against sexism. So again, this kind of altruistic, interesting idea about women being able to develop financial independence, but with this hideous overlay of the pyramid scheme preying on people. I'm also really interested in the kind of financial self-help myths, the rich dad, poor dads of the world, with this idea that you can think and grow rich, another classic of the genre, and the way that there's, I guess, this dual life where Linda and Peter are a perfect example, where they're living in dire poverty, but because of, I guess, this whole notion of manifesting wealth for yourself, they're forced to, I guess, keep up appearances. And it intersects very much then with the self-help, the social media culture, where they're cultivating this online persona that they are rich, they have the wealth that they wanted to manifest. And it's just an absolute collision course for those two distinct pathways.
Thank you for that, Ernest. I have written down The Dream. I'm checking that out.
It's a cracker of a series. It looks very much at the motivation for people getting involved in pyramid schemes.
Well, of course, they don't work. So when I say I don't think I ever got how they work, they don't. Mm. It always makes me think, and I'm wondering if we're of a similar vintage, this might resonate with you. The episode of, I think it's like, it's Angel, not Buffy. The episode of Angel where there's like the vampire pyramid scheme. Mm-hmm, it was just gorgeous. And I'm like, oh, okay, it kind of does make sense with vampires. Yeah.
I think there was such an allure. My family were early adopters with Amway. It was just such an allure that you could have some way of getting an extra income stream. Mm. And I think it's only, as I say, as social media has come to dominate our lives, the idea that you can be sold this myth that you can be financially free, as Linda would call it, merely by selling supplements, washing detergent, whatever the product happens to be, is really pervasive and powerful for people who see that.
Yeah. We are now about to enter, I don't think I've ever officially called it a final draft sub-segment, but it really is. It's been going on for years. And I'm going to call it, Andrew might be drawing too long a bow here. But like as I read, Linda's attitudes kind of showed me how in many ways, I guess that kind of cisgender binary idea is its own kind of pyramid scheme. And too often it's like the everyday world is just kind of shilling for these conventional gender representations. And, you know, if you can bring five more in, well, then we just pays out.
I love it. I love this. I certainly wanted to draw a parallel between Jack and Linda and their sort of belief systems. And I think Linda, again, like you're saying, that kind of presentation of gender and the idea that these are the norms. I mean, Linda herself doesn't adhere really to the kind of norms that she claims to be promoting anyway, which I think exposes the lie that you're talking about and the kind of falsehood at the center of it all.
So I want to acknowledge now, actually, because I was just the next question I want to ask you, I think it's important to frame it around the idea that this is this tremendous, dark, comedic, but you're going to feel like, am I allowed to laugh? But of course you are. And so much of the action happens in this Noosa rental, which is just incredible. Jack and Alice arrive. They work to support their ailing mother and father. Peter seems to be in cognitive decline, not that Linda will acknowledge this. So the action, it actually resides in this clash between the cringe of Linda's self-delusion and I guess the treading water virtue of Jack trying to be the better person. Now, you and I, again, we both know what's coming. We're not going to tell the listener. But I wondered, though, for you, did you ever worry that you had written yourself into an impossible problem here? Like, how were you going to get them out?
Absolutely. And I think, again, without wanting to spoil too much, it really could only come to a very dramatic and slightly absurd conclusion in order to, I guess, really fulfill the pathways here. But that's, to me, that's interesting as well, because I think the logical conclusion of the kind of beliefs that Linda and Peter have is absurd. And the gap between, as you say, Linda's delusion and the presentation and the kind of, I guess, the infrastructure that she builds up around this delusion, there's only one thing that can possibly happen, really. And that's the complete collapse. We won't spoil what that collapse looks like, but nonetheless, there was no way she could keep this kind of juggling act going for much longer, which is a perpetual, like, of perpetual interest to me with influencer culture, with wellness culture, how people can maintain the myths that they build up and what the end point is going to be for them when those myths are finally exposed. I think that's a really interesting question to grapple with.
Yeah, and it's interesting, that idea of complete collapse. I'm now rewinding us a little bit, because Linda is propping herself up with is external validation. But of course, before leaving NAM Melbourne, Jack goes to speak to his therapist, and what he is propping himself up with, or ostensibly trying to prop himself up with, is, I guess, internal reinforcement, as much as he will take the advice of his own choosing and leave the rest of Cameron's advice on the floor if he doesn't like it. And that's really interesting, because I feel like, you know, as much as it may feel like there's this spoiler in saying there's complete collapse, it's completely open as to where that's going to happen.
And I think to what extent Jack's willing to exercise his agency in his relationship with his mother, with his sister, he sort of wants to tread this fine line where, as you say, he wants to be the better person. He's not always capable of executing his best laid plans. He is very susceptible to his sister's sort of poking and prodding at the edges of his conscience. I think Jack is hopefully more aware than Linda of his failings, but nonetheless, the failings are there. So I think we're never too sure or confident that Jackie is going to necessarily follow through with those best laid plans.
Yeah, yeah. The Taylors, they seem to embody Tolstoy's adage that every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And throughout the novel, you have Linda, like, she blithely and often callously misgenders Jack, as well as uses transphobic slurs. This must have been hard to write.
Absolutely. And I think I really toyed with how much of this I wanted to put on the page, because I think also for any trans people reading the book, it wasn't something that I necessarily wanted to re-traumatize or reopen wounds. But I think for me, there was an importance in putting it on the page precisely to try and disentangle, I guess, the impact, and to think about, I guess, those broader questions around family and whether we have obligations to our biological family and what those obligations are and when they might be severed, what kind of actions are, I guess, unable to be repaired or to come back from within a family. And I think looking at Linda's use of language and her consistent kind of misgendering of Jack, as you mentioned, really reinforces for him the decision that he made a decade earlier to separate himself from the family. And I think the decade passes and he feels this pull back because of all the social pressures that go along with being a member of her biological family. But I think by the end of the novel, he kind of comes to the conclusion that maybe he was right all along.
Mm. Linda exists as a kind of extreme. We talked about caricature. I think at one point, Jack even wonders if she might be a TERF, or at least in some TERF-adjacent spaces. But there are, of course, there are less obvious, more covert forms of transphobia and anti-trans sentiment that exist in the world. Did you want the story to address these?
It was an interesting kind of proposition, because I wanted, part of wanting to write a trans character in the way that I wrote Jack was to not center his transness, but to look at ways that it impacted his family, it impacted his relationship with his family and his movement. There is a scene in an airport in the text as Jack's making his way to Noosa, where he encounters some of the gender policing that can happen in an airport space. And I did want to find a way to capture those moments, mainly to look at how they then, I guess, spun back on Jack when he hasn't got the safety of his biological family. Mm. So he encounters those experiences of transphobia in the wider world. He looks then to his family for some support and reassurance, and he can't find it. So to me, that's a really interesting question about you know, if you're exposed to those things and that experience of transphobia and you don't have the supportive family, what does that mean? What does that mean for Jack as a person?
That was a particularly harrowing scene. Like, it's, you wrote extremely well that building tension inside Jack's body. Like, I think for a lot of people, when we do feel tension in our body, it's often very hard to explain. And then it was constantly kind of pricked by Alice's just, she was completely unaware. Like, what's going on? Why are you like this? And I realized as you were explaining and Jack was building intention, like a little part of me just went, I was today years old when I figured out that's what those scanners are for. Like, I just, I have not flown for a very long time, but I just always, you know, decision, you just kind of go, this is, oh, okay. That's just a thing you do. It never occurred to me to think more of it. But for Jack, that was harrowing. And it was very, very, very well evoked on the page.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me to think about Jack's able to exist and he is read as male by most of the people that he comes into contact with. He doesn't have, you know, he has these moments where he thinks about race sort of tangentially. I think for me, I was interested in that moment in thinking about he's a white man who is read as a white man for most of his life, who is being exposed to, I guess, 1/100th of the pressure that a person of color or a trans woman, for example, might be exposed to in that situation. So I was really interested in, I guess, bringing that pressure to bear on a character who is lucky enough to escape it during a lot of his life.
Yeah, and I just want to take up that a little bit more, because it was something that I didn't write a question, but I popped it in my notes about the way, like, Jack is extremely well versed in sociocultural and geopolitical kind of perspectives on, like, broadly, but also the way his identity reflects out into the world. And because I had been reading Linda, who is so extreme, it was really interesting to think, am I reading this as coded extreme? Or for Jack, is this exactly what he needs to survive in a world that there's always the potential he will be othered?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think trying to navigate for him the relationship between all of these different factors, he's very conscious of his privileges. And I think at times he can be too self-aware. And not thinking about necessarily the impact that his family in particular is having on him. So he's thinking about what he's projecting out and not always thinking about what he's projecting in. So your point about, you know, he only really can understand what is happening through that really magnified gaze that is Linda, and someone who is willing, I guess, to hurt without any second thought.
I want to ask again. I've gone completely off script. I've got an ending question that I want to ask you, and so I'm a little part of it. I'm holding off because I'm really enjoying chatting about this book. But another thing that occurred to me as we were just talking there, I don't know if at any point throughout the novel we read a scene where Jack is happy. And that's actually because Jack is a really awesome character. Jack is a character from, or at least I think for people who know teachers, who love teachers, you want them to be happy because you know the shit that they go, sorry, language warning, Andrew, that they go through. But again, am I wrong? Or and if I'm not wrong, do you have a sense that at some point through the narrative that Jack is happy?
Really great question that I think when I came to the final draft of the novel, I was thinking about the fact that Jack doesn't interact with anyone but his family and his therapist throughout the novel. There's one point at which he goes to post on social media and he sort of thinks through whether he's going to text a friend or, but we don't actually see any other connection. And I think to me, I wanted to propel Jack out of any kind of comfort into this really unsettling space of his family. And I think there is no happiness for him on the page, and there's a real lack of connection with a community as well. And I think it wasn't a deliberate choice in the first few iterations. By the time I got to the final draft, it became a deliberate choice, because what I was really interested in was how this traditional space that is supposed to be somewhat safe, we know, of course, that it's not for many people, but it is supposed to. The myth is that the family unit is the safe space for us all. And I really wanted to push this character into this extreme discomfort to sort of see what the impact was on him and take him away from all of those things that his supports and his places of happiness.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, look, we can use all the sort of analogies of, you know, diamonds are made under pressure. But again, I talked at the beginning, like this novel hinges on character. The action is in characters and their responses. And so you're probably not going to finish this book if you don't fall a little bit in love with one of the characters. And God, it better be Jack. If you fall in love with Linda and you're listening to this show, you might not be listening to the right show. So
a morbid curiosity, maybe. Maybe a morbid curiosity about it.
Okay, yeah. Wow, the satisfaction they'll get. But I just, again, it's like, give Jack a hug. Which, of course, I guess it brings us to the ending. And I want to talk about the ending without talking about the ending. Every author, this is like, and it's something that happens off air. Like, so when we finish the, I say, look, I wanted to talk about so much, but of course, spoilers, it's new in the world, we can't spoil. Firstly, the ending is jaw-dropping, and I hope the listeners are excited to discover it. They're going to find themselves like turning back pages to check, like, did I just read that correctly? In the most general sense of this ending, though, you've talked a little bit about this idea of collapse. I wondered about how you came to the ending, and also then in the world that we live in this world where there is this ongoing public dehumanization of trans people online and often offline, was there ever another possibility? Like, I got the sense that there was no resolution that would have felt authentic.
And whether there was a possibility of almost a redemption arc, I guess, for the biological family.
That's a better way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, again, I'm probably straying into spoiler alerts here, but I think for me, the primary driver for wanting to engage with some of these ideas around family was to explode them and to think about family very differently from, I guess, the biological family unit that, despite many people's best efforts, is still the primary organizing factor in our society. And so I think for me, the most important thing for Jack was for him to come to some sort of resolution within himself about what was important and what he expected from those people he let into his life. So I think whatever kind of plot ending I had to come up with had to get Jack to that place where he came to some sort of degree of understanding of what he could expect from people around him and what was reasonable to ask of others. And I think him coming to that was the most important thing for me to see for him, if he was ever going to have any hope of happiness in the future, even if it's not within the boundary of the novel.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, tremendous. Before, when we were talking about Jack's happiness, I thought, like, because I care, I want to see more. It's not going to fly off the shelves if you write a book called Jack Gets a Hug and it's just about Jack being happy. But, I mean, maybe there is like a found family sort of sequel. This is just my mind canon right now. But, yeah, found family narrative's so hot right now too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, in that queer world that Jack inhabits, that is certainly a possibility for him as well.
I should have done this off air. This will obviously be cut, but I meant to check with you. Are there any events, especially Sydney-based events, because this is a Sydney-based show, that we should mention to let people
there
know?
There are not. No, I'm going to visit some Sydney bookstores, but I don't have anything concrete planned yet. So
No worries. That's cool. Look, if I come across it, because obviously I'll do a proper ending as well. April release. I've got my little arc, which on the on the corner says April.
Yeah, it's actually publication days next Tuesday. The 26th of March. So.
Awesome. Oh, yeah. Cool. Fantastic. Yeah. Well, then I don't have to worry about when we're popping. I thought I'm doing this well in advance because I'm having a bit of time off.
That's exciting.
Nice. tremendous. Well, let's do a proper radio ending. And yeah. All right. I am speaking with Ernest Price. We are discussing The Pyramid of Needs. This is a must read. It is so tremendous. So many ideas, Ernest. I really appreciate the time that you've taken with me today.
Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been fantastic.
Thanks for joining me today on the Final Draft podcast. Thank you again also to Ernest Price. Ernest's new book is called The Pyramid of Needs, and it is out now. Final Draft records on the lands of the Darug and Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. You can stay in touch here on Final Draft. Reach out on the socials. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. But you know what? The best way to say hello is just to subscribe. Give us a like. Give us a follow. However it works on your podcast app. It means you get new in conversations with Australian authors every week. It means you get bonus episodes. And it means that we get a little bit of a bump and other people will see us, which means more people discover Australian writing. My name's Andrew Popel. I'm going to be back next week with more incredible conversations from Australian authors here on Final Draft. Till then, happy reading. Bye for now.